Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
All right, welcome to this roundtable edition of Where Did the Road Go? And this one's a little different. Peter Bernard had sent me some comments he had. He did sort of a little podcast segment about a podcast we did when we talked about fiction and the paranormal, which was a very popular subject. Peter became a little concerned with my, we'll say, sanity. I think he mostly just misunderstood some of what I was saying. So we clarify in this podcast, and Peter makes some really, really good points. Pretty much we all agreed with. So we decided to kind of run with that and talk about some of the points he made because they were such good points, as well as clarify things that, because I figure if Peter misunderstood stuff, other people likely misunderstood as well. I have also, if you go into the show notes, you'll find a link that you can listen to the short 30-minute podcast of Peter talking about what he was so bothered by. He gave me permission to put it up and link it, so you can check it out yourself. And then you don't need it to listen to this show, so it's totally up to you whether you want to do that or not, but I just wanted it to be there so you could check it out. And so it provoked a very interesting conversation, as you will see. So I want to thank Peter for that and for permission to use the show, the podcast segment. And
one other note, for some reason, the two tracks, my track and the track that Tim and Joshua are on, misalign here and there. I fixed it as best I could. I don't know how this even happened. It's not something that's ever happened before. It shouldn't really be able to happen since the software is recording both channels in one file, left and right. But somehow it got off, and then it would come back in, and it would get off. So it might seem like we're talking over each other, and then there are awkward pauses. I did the best I could cleaning that up. I don't know what's going on there. We'll just hand that one over to the trickster. And so if it seems a little off here and there, that's why. And with that, here you go. All right, welcome to this roundtable edition of Where Did the Road Go? I'm here with Joshua Cutchin and Timothy Renner.
Greetings. Hello, guys.
And we're gonna start off with a email I received, and it's kind of, I don't know where the show is gonna go in its entirety, but I wanted to address this. There's a listener we have called Peter Bernard, and he works with, who does he work with a little bit?
I believe he's on, he works with Timothy Green Beckley's podcast, which I've been on a couple times, and I have a good relationship with Tim, so.
Okay, I know, I'm pretty sure I've listened to it a few times and enjoyed it. He said he recorded this for PQ Ribber's show, and I'm not sure who that is. But he sent this clip, and it's called Soraya Off the Tracks. And it is about how he feels I'm losing my mind. And it's not a malicious sort of an email or a podcast. The podcast is a little rambling, and at one point he sees like a robin or something, and then he's off trying to take a picture of the robin. it's actually a pretty entertaining listen to. But he kind of misunderstood some stuff that we dealt with in the fiction podcast, and I kind of want to make sure nobody else has. One of his big points, and he mentions this in the email, is that he thought it was really bad that I expressed guilt about listening or reading fiction. And I feel that way about a lot of things that are not constructive. Not that reading or whatever isn't constructive, but there's a lot of stuff I want to do. And I generally bite off a lot more than I can chew and just try to do it all. So, like, if I sit down and play video games, I tend to have this feeling of guilt. Like, I could be doing something constructive, but instead I'm playing video games. I've gotten better about it.
But I feel that way too when I sit and watch a movie or something. I got to be doing something else on the laptop and working on something while I'm watching a movie, or I have to, if I'm reading a fictional book, I'm thinking, but I want to, you know, I have all these other non-fictional books I want to read, and I might be able to do something with those, whereas this is more entertainment to me. Although sometimes it's also inspiration, because, you know.
I know exactly what you mean, and it's not necessarily even, I mean, some of it's being a workaholic, because I do that a lot, but like some of it's just getting stuff done-aholic, you know? Workaholic implies you're doing stuff because so you can make more money, but for me it's like, well, these dishes aren't going to clean themselves, so can sure, I just sit sure. there and watch them, you know, watch them rot, or I can actually go to some effort and, you know, put down like a video game controller or put down the book. Because I'm working my way through Mike's third book right now and I haven't had a chance to finish it because I've been trying to do other stuff and get other stuff done. So yeah, I totally get what you mean.
You know how I took it when you said that? I honestly thought, and this is true, like when I put my first book out, I did a lot of radio shows and not everybody read the book before they interviewed me. And you did, and you were in the minority, actually. A few did. But you were one of those that did, and you said that, you know, you read every book before you have people on. So when you said you kind of feel guilty reading fiction, I literally thought it was just because it was taking time away from you from reading.
Well, that's part of it too
for the show, yeah.
But I've always felt that way. That's not a new feeling. It doesn't stop me from reading fiction. I mean, I've read a ton of Dan Simmons books. I think he's brilliant. I've read everything Lovecraft's written. I've read Douglas Adams stuff and various authors in between here and there. I've had them on the show. I had, who wrote The Straw Man? Michael.
I know who you're talking about. I remember you were talking about it. It was a great interview.
Yeah. And he's also very into Fortiana. And, I cannot remember his Michael. It's Michael something. I can't remember it now off the top of my head, but you know, I mean, I went through all three of his books pretty much in a row and occasionally had to stop because, I needed to read a book for a guest. You know, it's not that I take this, you know, his Peter's email and thing was basically that we were taking this stuff too seriously. He quotes Kiel and saying, never believe anything about this stuff. Once you start believing anything, you will go insane. But I don't believe anything about this stuff. Like for example, when, I've talked about the experience where we were up on the cliff edge and on the other side of the tree line where we couldn't see that it sounded like something was jumping up and down and shaking this tree next to us.
Right.
And when I went around to the other side, there was nothing there. And the shaking would stop, and then I'd go back where I couldn't see again, and it would start up again. And there was nowhere for anything to run. I initially thought it was just a big buck, and I was like, oh, great. Are we going to have to like scale down the cliff because this buck thinks we're threatening its doe or something, you know? And I've had people tell me various theories of what that was. People have said, well, it's an invisible Bigfoot. Well, I can't prove it's not an invisible Bigfoot, but I don't attach any kind of label to this stuff. That was, I tell the experience like it happened. I don't know what it was. And unless some monster suddenly revealed itself one day and went, hey, remember that time at the cliff? Yeah, that was me. You know, I'm probably never going to know for sure what happened that day. But what is important to me is what I took away from it. What I took away from that experience is one of the two people I was there with did not see it, did not see the tree shaking, did not feel the ground shaking. He had a completely different experience than the other two of us had. And it was the person that I have had a lot of experiences with. So it's not something where he normally would block this stuff out. And I walked away from that experiencing, realizing that we don't all experience the same reality. Because I don't know how else to explain what happened there. Somehow he sat there, was freaking out because we were freaking out about something jumping up and down the other side of the tree and the tree shaking, and he wasn't seeing any of it.
Can we unpack that Kiel statement a little bit now, or do you want to get through more of the email first? Because I think we need to like kind of talk about what Kiel was saying there.
Yeah, go ahead, unpack it.
Obviously, Kiel wasn't saying don't believe every witness, right? Like,
right.
'Cause here's a guy who took a million reports down.
Sure.
He was saying, in my belief, was like, don't try to pin this stuff down, right? Because if you once you put a pin in it, it's gonna move, and you will end up looking foolish. case in point, you know, someone declares, you know, oh, I've solved the alien problem. It's demons or whatever, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
And then it's going to move. And, you know, it's the nature of this stuff is that it's slippery. Right.
So, and it changes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's part of all this. So I don't think he meant like, don't believe anything any witness ever says, because if that's the case, you know, we can burn a lot of John Keel books, right?
Right. yeah. And I think that's dead on. Yeah, and
Keel, just to sort of interject right quick, Keel was an interesting character in the fact that it was sort of like, I think I mentioned the other week that it was sort of like gonzo paranormal journalism. Like, I think that he captured the truth. I mean, like, people have talked about how we sometimes sort of fudge some facts, but I think the actual, like, you know, to use a Colbertism, the truthiness of the things that he was saying were intact. And I think that he definitely believed that there was some sort of actual, you know, phenomena going on. I just think that he was, you know, viewing it, especially towards later in his life, with a jaundiced eye. But, you know, even if there was some sort of level of fabrication, depending on the level of fabrication that might have been involved, he still had a way of thinking about these subjects that's still worth, you know, addressing. That's sort of tangential to what we're talking about, but I think it needs to be addressed too.
I agree. I totally agree. And I've always kind of taken that to heart, to never like lock anything down with this stuff, because we can't prove any of it. We can say with a fair amount of confidence that strange things happen to people.
Well, and that's really what a true 14 is they just sort of, they put the data there and they let it sit there. Like, you know, there's this person saw a talking dog. I'm not making a judgment call on it. I'm telling you that this person said that they saw a talking dog. You know, it's there was a great quote on Rune Soup by Jeff Kripal about comparing the Our Lady of Fatima events and UFOs, and saying that, you know, the bad comparativist will do is say all UFOs are Blessed Virgin Mary apparitions, or all Blessed Virgin Mary apparitions are UFOs. But what the good comparativist will do is just say, look, here are these two similar phenomena that express themselves in a similar way, but are viewed through different cultural lenses. What it is, I don't know, but there are definitely similarities there. And I think that's sort of in the spirit of a true 14, and that's kind of what, you know, I think if you spend enough time in this, that's where, you know, a healthy mindset really sort of arrives at.
It's hard. Yes. It's hard not to go there, I think, you know, unless you're devoted to you know, aliens being little scientists from another planet, or Bigfoot being an ape in the woods. If you're really open, you're going to start recognizing the similarities between all these things, at least I would think. And I really feel like that's one of the drums we beat here, you know, pretty regularly.
Yes, I'll definitely agree with that. I mean, like, for example, with me, like, I stopped worrying about objective truth of things a long time ago. You know, if something is a proven hoax, or something smells fishy, or something looks dubious, I won't include it in my work. But as far as like tracking down the absolute veracity of every single thing, all I can do is say that this is I can show you the source. I can say it's a reputable source. I can say that is well sourced. Sometimes I'll go, you know, back to the original source of a quote or something, but it's usually where I leave it. And if something has a thematic motivic resonance with other aspects of the phenomena, that usually is enough for me, because even if that particular incident or case that I talk about isn't true, there are, you know, 10 others that sort of express that same motif in the stuff that I work on. So I think that, like, I think that this is going to be taken out of context, but I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I think we get wrapped up too much with the actual truth of these things, as opposed to looking at these phenomena in aggregate. You know, don't look at the trees, look at the forest.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And yeah, that could easily be taken out of context.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it will be.
Peter also expressed, so Peter said that he is a big Andy Kaufman fan. It's one of his biggest influences. And he was talking about how he has occasionally made up stories about stuff. And he wasn't really clear about exactly what he did or how he did it or if he exposed himself afterwards. But he also kind of suggested that most people who have paranormal stories are probably making them up. And I feel like that's one of those things that people project outwards. You know, he's done it, so he assumes that's what other people are doing. But my sense when I talk to people, especially when I talk to people one-on-one, not on the show, and they tell me about these experiences they've had, and they don't really want everyone to know about them, and they're just, you know, this weird... I'll get total skeptics, people who don't believe in any of this, and then they'll say, there was this one thing, though, and I don't know what to make of it. And then they'll go and tell me the story about this weird thing that happened to them. It was a one-off thing that they you know, have never been able to explain. I don't think these people are making it up, by and large.
Or people who deliberately go out of their way to not be identified.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of reminds me of what you've always talked about, Soraya, in regards to Uri Geller and the spoon bending. Just because you can fake spoon bending doesn't mean that spoon bending is always fake. Just like because right. you can fake a punch for a film, as I think you use this analogy, just because you can fake a punch for a film doesn't mean that people don't actually get punched in the face, you know?
Exactly. The only thing about this whole little rant that he went off on, the only thing that bugged me is he misquoted me a couple of times pretty severely. One, he said that I hate horror. I had stated that I hate horror fiction writers. I have never said anything of the sort. I actually like sci-fi more than horror considerably, but I like cosmic horror, like Lovecraft type stuff, quite a lot. I never said anything even remotely like that. The closest thing I said is that it irks me a little bit when shows like The Black Tapes or Tanis or Rabbits, which are all Northwest Stories creations, don't give any indication that they are stories. Like, it's obvious to me, listening to them, that they are fiction. But if you go to the websites are all set up like all this stuff is real. There's an old term in wrestling called kayfabe. And kayfabe was you continue the story outside of the ring. So back in the 80s, you would hear stories about how Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan hated each other so much they couldn't fly on the same plane together. These guys tended to, you know, they stayed away from each other in bars. Breaking kayfabe was like the ultimate sin in wrestling. You kept the story going even outside of the ring. And that's kind of what like Tandis and the Black Tapes and stuff are doing. There's no indication anywhere that they're stories. And that was the only thing that irks me a little, because that does muddy things a touch, you know, because you get people who will listen to this, and it's very clear from some of the phone calls they air that a lot of people think this is real. These people are really having, you know, doing this research. And I'm like, okay, these are really good podcasts. I really like them. But that just, it irked me a little. It didn't make me mad. It was just kind of like, I think somewhere you should have a disclaimer on the site, even if it's small, just saying this is a fictional creation. And if people can't find that, well, so be it. But at least have it there in case people have questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's valid. I mean, for me, I was on the fiction show. I didn't take anything away from it where you said you didn't like horror writing or anything. In fact, quite the opposite. You were kind of describing these shows and almost doing a advertisement for them.
Well, sure, because I think people should listen to them. They're really good. They have really creative ideas in them. The other thing he said, and he quoted me as saying, I didn't think anybody should write Bigfoot horror fiction. Now, I don't think those words have ever come out of my mouth.
Yeah, I was trying to remember even where they could, I'm guessing that has something to do. I'm sure if Bigfoot was brought up, I'm the one who brought it up.
I have gone on the record as saying that there's a lot of bad Bigfoot horror fiction. Nice moment. I don't think anybody's really nailed it. I think probably Legend of Boggy Creek has come close to it, but that's more like a dramatization sort of situation. As far as straight ahead, horror fiction, I don't think anybody's really nailed it. I've seen some stuff that's better than others, but I don't know.
And I can totally appreciate the, let's call it the keeping kayfabe at times, like what the Blair Witch Project did. That marketing campaign was brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant.
That movie would have done nothing had it not been for that marketing campaign. And the marketing campaign suggested that it was real.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time researching that, but before the movie was released, when they kind of leaked the story a little bit, doing some serious research to figure out, you know, okay, wait a minute, where are these missing people? What are they talking about here? And it you know, now this was the earlier days of the internet. It wasn't quite, you know, nowadays it seems like people are much quicker to expose this stuff as a, you know, a fake. You know, but it took me a good while. I you know, a couple nights of really kind of digging in. I remember before I was like, nah, I'm pretty sure this is like they made it up for the movie. In fact, I had to inform some people, you know, I went to the premiere, I remember, in Maryland, and I had to inform some people afterwards who were quite disturbed, like, you know, hey, it's a good story, but no.
Yeah, and it was brilliantly done, and I'm fine with people doing stuff like that, because it comes out eventually that, no, this was just a marketing thing. You know, Fargo, look at Fargo. The initial movie, you know, say, well, they all do, all the TV series and the movie and everything all say based on real events and blah, 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 which they're not. And there was that one woman from China, which they made a movie about called Tomiko the Treasure Hunter.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And she didn't understand that this wasn't real, because it said it was real, and she took her life savings and she traveled to Fargo to try and find that suitcase with all the money in it. And it utterly destroyed her life. Now, I think most people realize Fargo wasn't a real story. And if they don't, it's probably not going to destroy their life. You know, this woman took it to an extreme, and it, you know, it had an unfortunate end. And that's actually a good movie as well, the Kimoko the Treasure Hunter. It's not quite what happened, but it's similar enough. And it's tragic, but it's interesting.
I've seen the film. I didn't realize it was based on anything true at all.
Oh, the treasure hunter one? Yeah, that woman really did go to Fargo and try to find the treasure, the suitcase.
Yeah.
However, she didn't die in the wilderness like they put in the film. I think she actually got into a relationship with the cop. If you look it up, all the information's online. I think she had gotten into a relationship with the cop and things went bad. And I think she might have killed herself a few years later or something like that. It was not a happy ending. The ending in the movie was actually a little bit better than what happened in real life. Mm. But, you know, I mean, these things do happen. You had, you know, Linda Moulton Howe repeatedly telling George Norrie that the Fourth Kind movie was not real, and him going, but it said it was based on real events, you know? And it's like, yes, it was a terrible movie, but it was well done in that respect, where they had, like, supposedly the real people, and then you had like Mila Jovovich and stuff acting out some of the scenes and stuff. It's like, okay. Yeah,
people think that there's some sort of legislation that keeps people from saying that something's based on a true story, but there isn't. There's nothing.
Yeah. And a lot of times, you know, something will be based on a true story because there's one fact in it that was true. Or it's even like, you know, you get like the TV show Haven was based on the Stephen King novel of what the hell was it? Something Kid. I can't remember. It's a short story, actually, I think, of his. And as I'm watching Haven, which was not all that good, it started getting really weird near the end. And I'm thinking, okay, they clearly didn't have this planned out, because the stuff they're coming up with at the end with all this interdimensional stuff, it's kind of interesting. It's not particularly well done, but it's interesting. And I looked it up and I said, how much of this is based on the Stephen King novel? And it's like, oh, the town name and a couple of the characters. Oh. So none of this is like a completely different thing, but it's based on the Stephen King story because they took the town name and a couple of the character names. So you can't really trust that stuff. You know, I mean, just because it says it's based on true events, or it's, you know, when I did Gateways to Magonia, I put it at the beginning based on true events, or I put it on somewhere on there, because it was approximations. That's not the word I'm trying to say. It was approximately what happened to me in certain circumstances, but made more interesting to be watched than what actually happened. Or the case with the main character driving along the road and he sees the guy in what looks like a tinfoil spacesuit. That came from an actual UFO case, but it wasn't the exact thing.
it was the general idea. I was trying to give the general feel of what these experiences feel like and what people go through, rather than recreating exact experiences.
Well, and you know, this is something I talk about this a lot, and I probably talked about it on the last show that we did, but I'll say it again. You know, certain things can be, I remember Patrick Harper in Demonic Reality talks about certain things being fictional, but being true. And the idea that like there can be a fictional story about, for example, a love that nails the truth of what it is to be in love better than any, you know, better than any factual story that's out there. Sure. So in a sense, it's true, even though it can be fictional. And I think that's something that we forget a lot about in our pursuit of absolutes.
Yeah. Yeah. That is. So yeah, I guess that was what I wanted to clarify really with this email that Peter, sent. And I have no idea if that's when or whatever that's going to be put up. But he did say PQ Ribbers show, so if people want to hear it.
Well, the other thing he said is that we, and I think this was addressed to all of us in general, is take ourselves too seriously, right? That was the...
Yeah, he did say that.
And I would not be involved in this if I took myself too seriously.
Well, it reminds me of my favorite Alan Rickman quote, which is, I take my work very seriously and myself not at all.
I mean, that's true. I mean, I seriously love this stuff. I do. I am seriously interested in this stuff. But
yeah,
at that, you know, part of all this is pretty crazy. I mean, you run into some crazy people, both legitimately and just, you know, the story, crazy kind of wacky sounding stories. And you're going to run into hoaxes. It's going to happen. It's part of,
oh yeah,
it's part of this field. I don't particularly like it, but I think it's part of the whole thing somehow. There's a lot of really respected researchers that end up involved in hoaxes or other kind of weird, sketchy schemes in all aspects of this stuff, which it seems to be part of it for some reason.
And in the email, he keeps repeating that we've become dogmatic, and I think that's the farthest thing from what we've become.
Specifically, it was me and Red, right? That were...
Well, and that you guys have made me be more dogmatic, and I'm thinking, really? Because they've come up with things that I didn't think of that opened my mind. For like even the Poltergeist thing. I have a three-part show with Jenny Ashford on Poltergeist, and initially my feeling on Poltergeist, and it has been for a long time, was that Poltergeist were spontaneous PK from, you know, a particular, generally a kid, going through puberty and having other issues, and for whatever reason these things trigger up. And it was Red Pill who said, but who's to say there's not some kind of intelligence that's also leeching off of that? And I stopped and I thought and went, well, so much for that idea. And I tossed that out and I said, now there's at least two things it can be.
Well, and I'll jump like, yeah. So Miguel is like probably the least dogmatic person that I know, but I'll jump on the dogma grenade a little bit, because I'm well aware that I've gone further and further down that fairy rabbit hole.
But you're not dismissing other ideas.
No.
Dogmatic people, they tend to only work within certain confines. They have certain walls they don't go past. And I don't think any of us are afraid to go past whatever walls.
Yeah. I think I was saying before we started recording that I think, If we're dogmatic about anything, it's maybe that we feel like there's connections between all this weird stuff. But at the same time, if someone proves those are just coincidences, I don't think anybody on this show is going to fight that. You know, if it's somebody's belief that, no, they're not related, they're all just coincidences, we're not going to yell at them, you know, tell them they're wrong.
And like I said, when I talked about my experience, I had a couple people actually suggest that was Bigfoot. That was an invisible Bigfoot. And like I said, I can't disprove it, but the only way I would say it was an invisible Bigfoot is if one day a real Bigfoot walked up to me and said, hey, remember that time at the woods on the cliff?
or he posts a misconnections ad in the newspaper.
Right. In which case I'd have to admit, all right, it was an invisible Bigfoot. How do I know? Well, here he is to talk about it, you know? But other than that, I assume I'm never really going to know, just like most of my experiences, I'm never really going to know what they are. It's all about what you take away from them.
Yeah, and that's the thing with a lot of this stuff. at some point we have to accept, and again, I hope I'm proven wrong. I really hope I'm proven wrong. But where I stand right now in regards to all this stuff, at some point you have to accept you're not going to get answers. You know, there's no real final answer forthcoming. The Bigfoot is not going to tap you on the shoulder and tell you, yeah, that was me. I was invisible.
But what if he did?
If he did, then I'm wrong, right? Hey,
exactly. Awesome.
But it doesn't mean you can't participate in the search. It doesn't mean you can't be interested in all this stuff. It doesn't mean you can't at least look for the answers. I just don't have a lot of confidence that we're going to find them. We'll have theories about them. And hey, maybe one day they'll be proven, but you know.
Well, you know, we may find a piece of the puzzle. However, we have no idea how many pieces there are to the puzzle. And there could, for all we know, be an infinite number of pieces to the puzzle.
The puzzle seems to be a fractal that doesn't stop moving.
Right.
Or ending.
And it's also, it's also because we are participating in all of this. You know, the eyeball cannot see itself directly. You can see it in the mirror. You can take a picture of it. But you can't look directly at your eyeball. And reality, consciousness, all of this may be very much like that. We can never see it directly. It's always going to be a symbol or a representation of what's there because we can't see it directly, because we're a part of it.
Yeah, I think that's completely valid.
He also referenced in the email, whatchamacallit, from Blink 182. He just writes, cough, cough, Blink 182, about people taking themselves too seriously and believing too much into this stuff. What's his name? The guy from Blink
182. I'm so happy I don't know it.
Tom DeLong.
Tom DeLong, thank you. And in the rant, he's talking a little bit about Benowitz. Although he can't remember his name, but that's who he's talking about, how they messed with Benowitz and he literally went insane from the disinformation campaign that was raised against him. And I don't think any of us are even remotely like that, where we're trying to push any kind of paradigm or belief system. He actually said something about you, Joshua, and Red Pill trying to create almost a new religion of Fortiana.
Like that. Oh man, do I get to be like a duke, like a kick-ass duke or something, or a kick-ass deacon?
So I guess You've been outed. I'm sorry. We were trying to keep that secret. But I mean, I want people to communicate with one another. I think that is one of the most important things we could do. Stop yelling that you have the answers and actually talk to other people. Talk to people who have different ideas. Never cut any of this stuff out because we don't know. You know, I mean, we were briefly talking about some of the comments we'll get where everything is demons. You know, and you get people who are very religious who just think that anything that's paranormal is demons. Well, that's not an answer. You know, we don't even know if demons exist. That's a belief system. That's, if you're looking for an actual explanation, you're going to have to do better than that.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Tim.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's just like we were saying, you're just putting another name on something. You're not really solving it. One person's demon is another's archetype is another's, you know, these are all just, we're putting names on them, but you're still not really kind of solving what's going on. It's, you just put a different label on it.
So, I mean, if anything, I want to encourage people to be open-minded. I want to encourage people to talk to one another, because yelling at one another does not achieve anything. The worst thing you can do if you disagree with someone is to yell at them, because now they're defensive and they're not going to listen to you. I don't think it's that hard for people to really just communicate if you let your egos out of it. I loved putting together Aaron Gullius and Mike Cleland, who came at, you know, the UFO subject from very different views and didn't necessarily agree with each other all the time, but they never argued about it. They never insulted one another. They just told their view and then, you know, discussed it.
I would have to say that if I am starting a new if I am starting a new 14 religion, it's probably one of just contrarianism. Like that's the thing that I find myself doing all the time, is that if somebody comes along with, you know, an answer, I generally like to try to poke holes in it. Even if it's something that I'm sympathetic to, yes, I love to poke holes into it. You know, I'll get mad when people say that there's no evidence of extraterrestrial visitation. Well, there kind of is, even though that's not my personal axe to grind. And then, you know, when people come along and say that there's evidence of, you know, alien life or blue avians lurking at the edge of the solar system, like, I'm the first person to poke holes in that too. I guess like if I'm probably guilty of that, of just trying to walk that line.
Yeah, and I always like to play devil's advocate on that stuff. If I have a guest on for an interview, I'm not generally going to argue with them. That's not my goal. Sometimes I'm going to throw some things out there that strike me about what they're talking about. Sometimes they're interested in talking about that. Sometimes they're not. But I'm not generally playing devil's advocate when I bring on someone to talk about their theory, because I want them to express what they want to express, and I figure people can figure it out from that point on their own. And then if we want to talk about it later, we can do that. But yeah, by and large, anything, you should always question everything. You should never settle on any idea as being absolute truth, because no matter how true it may seem, it's probably not. Everything we know is probably wrong.
Especially in regard to this stuff. I mean, it's so slippery. Yeah. As soon as you try to nail it down, it'll change on you.
I mean, Alex Sakaris there had his book where he said, what did he call it? Science is wrong about just about everything. And of course, people misunderstood that, think, you know, being like, well, but science can do this and that. And but his point was that because science doesn't take consciousness into part of the equation, it is by default wrong because it's missing a part of the equation. It might have most of the parts right enough to function, but he's suggesting
it can never be infallible. Yeah.
Significant. Right. And I agree with that. And I think science is something that as you know, how many times in history have scientific groups decided that we've discovered everything? You know, back in the 1800s, the Royal Academy of Sciences was saying something like, you know, we've discovered everything there is to be discovered. It's now just working.
The thing is, you mentioned that to someone who's like neck deep in scientism, and they'll science explain it to you. They'll be like, well, yeah, but our methods have improved and we're more objective than we were then. And we've cast off the shackles of religious, you know, dogma. And you're like, no, you haven't. You just like shifted everything, you know, up one. Or, you know, it's like, I think there are some things that we have a better understanding of, but like, if you look at, I know I've brought this up on the show multiple times in the past, but like, there are some very fundamental things about reality that we just don't understand. Like, we still don't have, we have a knowledge of what happens during sleep and why it's important to us, but we don't know exactly why we need to sleep. And there are these little things like that, that I'm sure a lot of people think are just sort of, you know, settled science. And it's actually, a lot of it's, you know, I talked about in my last book, like, we don't understand how we smell exactly. The mechanism isn't entirely, you know, consensus settled, you know. So it boggles my mind when people think that, oh no, we're better than we used to be. No, we're the exact same people we used to be. You know, we're just shifting shifting all our ideas, you know.
Well, we have more information, and we do have some better tools to work with.
Right. But I totally agree with that. At the same time, I think that we've also, you know, thrown out, there are probably a lot of babies that have gotten thrown out with a lot of bathwater.
I had a sort of internet argument with a friend of mine who is very militant atheist, very scientism, like, you know, believes in science to the point where it's a religion to him. And he had put up a quote. Was it him that put up a quote? Someone put up a quote, and I think it was Dawkins who said, oh, you don't believe in evolution and so on and so forth. Well, some comment about gravity and how you could go throw yourself off a building or something like that. And I said, but people can feel gravity in everyday life. They don't see evolution in everyday life, you know? So that's really kind of a invalid sort of comparing gravity to evolution. And he, for some reason, kept arguing that we do see evolution in everyday life and wouldn't go into detail on how that is. So I really wasn't sure what he was getting at. Unless he was saying, you know, because we're the result of evolution, but he really wasn't responding to that at all. But at the same time, we say that, and we don't understand gravity. Yes, you can feel gravity because it holds you to the earth, whether it's round or flat, I guess. we have the calculations, the mathematics to utilize gravity when we don't send people to the moon. And we can put satellites up in space. We know the mathematics. We know enough about it to utilize it. But what people probably don't realize is we don't actually know what gravity is. That's why we were searching for some of these subatomic particles with CERN, because we don't know what gives things their mass. We don't know why gravity works. And it's such a simple seeming thing. It's so fundamental to our existence. It's what holds us to the planet. And we don't actually have any clue how it works or why.
Yeah, I think, was it the same video where Dawkins is saying, like, you know, how do I know that science works? Because I can fly in an airplane or something like that.
Maybe. I don't know. It was just a quote. I didn't actually, it wasn't a video.
Yeah, like there's, there are certain things that I, stuff like that. Like, yeah, that's obviously that's effective. You know,
we know how some of this stuff works, even if we don't know exactly
right.
why it works. And of course you look at like the Big Bang Theory. Why is dark matter such a big deal? Because without dark matter, the Big Bang Theory has an enormous hole in it, which is why you see scientists rallying around this dark matter idea, because it has to be there, because if it's not, then they're really missing something fundamental about the universe. And it might be that the Big Bang never happened. There's actually a number of things wrong with the Big Bang Theory, which we've dealt with on other shows, but you hear more and more real scientists, not so much the TV scientists, when they're asked about dark matter, they go, yeah, it probably doesn't exist. Because they've done so much research on it, and they've looked at it for it in every possible way, and it's just not there.
Yeah, well, I think sometimes it's been used as just sort of a placeholder, right?
Sort of. But they have an idea of what it needs to be. The missing mass of the universe is what it needs to be, and they don't have it. Which means that that mass just isn't there.
Right. Right.
So the whole expanding universe thing falls apart. The whole Big Bang idea falls apart. So now they need to find something else to replace the dark matter idea. Because it was basically they did the math and they sat down and they said, well, most of the universe is missing. And instead of saying, well, maybe this whole Big Bang thing is wrong, they said, no, it just must be invisible. And hence dark matter.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the underpants gnomes from South Park. You know, step one, steal underpants. Step two, step three, profit. You know, the algebra, we're sort of solving it backwards, and the algebra doesn't quite work, but we're assuming that we're going to make a profit. So there's got to be a step two. Well, maybe there's not a step two.
Well, and the thing is, it's perfectly idea to perfectly scientific and valid to propose the idea of dark matter. Well, we can't find this missing matter. Where is it? Oh, it must be invisible. Great. Let's find out if that's true. And for decades, we've been trying to find out if it's true, and everything says no.
Yeah, it's sort of what it's sort of similar to what Rupert Sheldrake said about consciousness studies. He calls it the false promissory note of materialism. That, you know, oh, don't worry, one day we'll have this nailed down. Just trust us. One day it's going to be nailed down. And it, you know, that day keeps on getting pushed back.
Oh, sure. Because we're probably approaching it from the wrong angle. It's not a simple materialist break it down type of thing. And in fact, that seems to be consistently proved wrong when people come up with theories on how they can break down consciousness, and it doesn't work like that.
I mean, yeah.
You know,
I've grown. Speaking of being dogmatic, if there's one thing that I will argue with people about, it is consciousness studies and how materialism is has long overstayed its welcome.
I was thinking about this the other day. Someone will have, you know, a kid and they'll say, "Whoa, that's new life," but it's really not. Everything that is alive today, as far as we know scientifically, started from the first life that existed on this planet and has been in an unbroken chain up to us and everything else that exists today. So the first life, you know, split off, created different things, but there was always this spark of life that is passed on from one to the other. There is no point where there's dead matter that is then brought to life.
That's an excellent point.
It's a little frightening when you think about it, because there's literally one point that started all of our existence, all of our consciousness. We can't just take a corpse and animate it. We can't Frankenstein something together. It has to be connected to something else.
And it makes me sort of, it's also frightening in another way for me, because it makes it all seem that much more tenuous in some ways. Like, you know,
yes. Well, that's what I mean.
It's almost like if somebody breaks the circuit, then we're done.
All of life could be done if that circuit isn't continued.
Yeah, exactly.
Tim, you've been quiet.
No one said anything about Bigfoot for like 15 minutes.
Oh, you act like you're just a Bigfoot guy. You're so not.
You know, I forgot what I was going to say. I was going to try to bring in Bigfoot somehow, but I came up with nothing. I was just going to riff on it, but I got nothing.
Well, technically, if Bigfoot is a flesh and blood animal, he's connected in that line somewhere.
Isn't that? Look at that. We can hold hands and we can sing and then he can rip our hands off. And
well,
you know, basically when you create new life, as people call it, you're creating a new separate consciousness, a new ego, but it's like the extension of the same life.
What I've been a fan of, and this is because that's one of the things that all the, you know, the people who poo-poo the idea of reincarnation say, well, how come there are, you know, more people on the planet than there ever have been before? I like to conceptualize possibly that consciousness is like an ocean and each ego is a wave and it rises and it falls and returns to the same thing. There's a finite moment of time as it sort of emerges from this greater entity with sort of an individuality, and then it falls back in. And bits of that get pulled into other crests and other waves and other troughs. And perhaps that sort of explains, you know, I think it's a nice, tidy way of sidestepping around there being so many people. And it also sort of really comes to that idea that, you know, of humanity having a certain aspect of oneness, which I think is not only poetic, but has a lot of truth to it.
Well, look, man, I just lost what I was just going to say. The sense of one. Yep, I've lost it. I've completely gone. It was really good. It was really good, though. I promise you. And the thing is, you know, we look at things like reincarnation. There's evidence for reincarnation. I don't take the regression therapy stuff, the hypnosis stuff, seriously when it comes to reincarnation. I never have.
Yeah, but the Jim Tucker stuff is really good.
You mean everyone's not a princess or a great warrior in their past life?
It's always ancient Egypt, isn't it?
usually. The Jim Tucker stuff with the children who are spontaneously able to recall past lives and you know, can speak in other languages and can deal with concepts that kids of, you know, 2 years old shouldn't be able to understand and will flat out say, oh, this was my last life, you know. It doesn't mean that that's what it is, but it's definitely, if you're using Occam's razor, hey, that is the simplest solution, that they're simply relating what happened to them. But if we are kind of in a general pool of consciousness that just separates out here and there, they could be just pulling that from the pool. It could be that there's a spirit wandering around and it latched onto these kids, and the kids don't understand that it's not them, and they're relaying the spirit's life. It could be a psychic experience of some sort, but I think reincarnation is probably the most likely.
It's the most parsimonious answer. Yeah.
Yeah. It also doesn't mean that everyone reincarnates. This is the other thing. We think that whatever happens at death happens to everyone, but that's not necessarily the case. We may get a choice when we die. Do you want to go to this place? Do you want to go to this place? Do you want to reincarnate? Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? We don't know. We know nothing about.
Well, and you know, I mean, it reminds me of, an Egyptian afterlife, Ahmet, you know, the lion, hippopotamus, crocodile deity that would, you know, if your heart was too heavy, weighed against a feather, would sort of just eat your soul into oblivion.
Right. Which could be rejoining the pool of consciousness. I mean, there are other ideas out there that, you know, your individual consciousness will rejoin that sort of general stream unless you have gotten to a certain point of enlightenment, in which case you escape it. You escape that cycle. I mean, there's so many different theories and
thoughts. You know what my gut feeling is? My gut feeling is that whatever happens is just going to lead to more questions. We're not going to get this big revelation. Like, okay, you're dead. Here's all the answers. Now you know. It's just right. Going to be like another state filled with a bunch of more questions. I know that's really unsatisfying, but just that's what my gut tells me. It's just like, yeah, every other experience I've had is when, you know, you usually when it's a big kind of mystery and you find, you know, okay, what's behind this door? Oh, 10 more doors, you know?
But they're more interesting doors usually.
Absolutely can be.
You know, it can really, you know, we were talking about, I know what it was I was going to say. You were talking about a limited number of souls to reincarnate or whatever. Look out at the universe. And if you look at some of these photos that they've taken with these high-powered telescopes, where you have all these dots, and each one of those dots is a galaxy. We can't process that. We can't process the sheer number of solar systems or even galaxies that we're looking at. I mean, these things are bigger than anything we know. The sun itself is bigger than anything we know. I mean, we can't really understand the size of the Earth itself, much less these much bigger things out in space. And we look at that, and it's literally like looking at infinity. Our brain cannot process what we're looking at there. So if that's just what a telescope can pull up, why are we limiting anything? Just because we don't understand infinity, our brain doesn't work like that, does not mean there's not infinity.
Right. I just saw a stoner thought on Facebook that I love that said, you know, if we didn't have eyes, we wouldn't understand color. So what if there's something fundamental about reality that we don't possess the organ to understand, you know?
Oh yeah.
And conceptually, absolutely. Could we even construct an instrument that could somehow tap into that? No, hell no.
I mean, we can construct instruments to say measure ultraviolet light because we can see, we know there's sight. And so we can kind of expand on, we know there's sight. So what's outside of what we can see normally, but if there's a sense there that we have no clue about, there's no way for us to discover it.
Right.
So, you know, also when you look at things like the Big Bang Theory seems like a nice explanation about where we came from, you know, but it really doesn't explain where we came from. It's like, oh, everything was squeezed down to a singularity and one day things imbalanced and exploded, and it's like, okay, well, where did that singularity come from? As who was it that made the quote, science says, give us one miracle and we can explain everything?
Yeah, that was Terrence McKenna quote. Give us one good miracle, yeah, and we can just take care of the rest.
You know, it's entirely possible that the universe has always existed. again, we can't conceive of that. We can't conceive of the time periods in the you know, back to the Big Bang either, really.
Well,
when you think about it, life is the longest thing we know. We don't really understand anything beyond how long we've been alive.
We're pretty, you know, it's pretty clear that time doesn't really work the way that we have structured it for ourselves. We have a very linear concept of time, probably so we don't go crazy. But it's become pretty clear that time isn't necessarily that linear, and right. that, you know, really everything that's happening or that ever happened might all be happening technically at the same time. We just cannot understand that. You know what I mean? Like the way we sense things, and in order to not go insane, I think we need some form of linear time.
Well,
one of my favorite quotes from Seth was something akin to him saying that time passes at the rate that your mind can process reality. So that's where time exists. It exists in your consciousness. Your consciousness needs to experience it in sequential order, and your feeling of how quick time passes happens. It's almost like your processor speed of your brain. It can only process so much. So if you have a lot going on, it seems like time flies. If you're just sitting around doing nothing, it seems like time's dragging. And it's because your brain, you know, time moves based on what you can process at any given time.
Right. Yeah, it seems legit. I mean,
and you know, it's interesting because I have, we were just talking earlier before we start push record about, you know, people who throw around the word quantum and don't really know what it means. And they were trying to sound sciencey by throwing around that word. Yeah. But like without diving too deep into those waters and making a fool out of myself, I think that anyone who looks at a lot of what's coming out in terms of research, quantum research, this whole, you know, wibbly wobbliness of time is becoming very, very apparent. It's you're starting to read things about the observer effect, which we've known for a long time, affecting events in the past. Events in the past being defined by the way that things are observed in the present. And people will say, well, no, that just means I've been science-splained about this before, but if I'm misinterpreting it, everybody else is, and y'all need to do a better job of trying to get across what you're trying to say, because it doesn't sound like, you know, I don't think the message is coming across if that's what you mean. What it sounds like to me is that, yes, that time is not the way that we perceive it, and that your reality is starting to look a lot more like our reality.
In Robert Schoch's latest book, near the end, he talks about some new scientific studies and stuff that have been done that bring into question what we know about science. And one of them was something like that. It was something like if kids felt that they were prepared and were going to do well on their tests, they tended to do better than the kids who thought that they weren't prepared. But even if the kids... I forget exactly how it worked, but something like it even worked after the fact. Like, so if after the fact they convinced them they did well on their tests and they really believed it, and they went back and found that those kids' scores tended to be higher than the kids who were convinced they were going to do badly, even if they were convinced.
Yeah, it reminds me of,
as long as the scores weren't checked.
It reminds me of examples I have heard about, and don't ask me to tell you where I've heard of it. I just know that I remember hearing this. I think it was in an old Mysterious Universe. Examples where people had blood work drawn and then did something after they had the blood drawn that ended up affecting the blood sample that they had given. If memory serves correctly, which, you know, sounds to me like more of a, not only a fluidity of time, but it really implies, you know, again, or underscores rather, the importance of consciousness, I think.
Yeah, the interconnectedness of, you know, entanglement, There you go. There's a nice quantum term. There, the
All right. Well, I think we've gone over this pretty nicely and got pretty deep there. I am going to give a shout out to a couple other fictional podcasts that I did not know of when we did do our fictional show. One is The Box, and it's just like The Box podcast or something like that. Really interesting. It's kind of like The X-Files meets H.P. Lovecraft.
Nice.
And it gets the girl really paced herself at the beginning. She was doing almost like two episodes a week. And I'm like, I'm coming in much later on and I'm going, how did she keep up this pace? Did she just make a million episodes and then just start releasing them one after another? Because my God, and they're very well done. And it's an interesting story. The only point where I felt a little antsy with it is like there was maybe a 2-hour episode near the end where she's starting to learn that the stories she thinks she's reading that are fiction are actually real. And she's talking to like various experts on like the paranormal and stuff. But of course they're not real experts on, they're all actors. And I'm thinking, so I'm listening to fake interviews about paranormal when I have like 36 interviews with real people about the paranormal on my podcast list that I want to listen to. And I'm like, okay, this is one of those cases where I really like the stories, but the thing is, I'll tell you what, she knows her stuff enough to create believable interviews with people who are, like I said, quote, experts. You can't really be an expert on the paranormal. There's no school to go to, really, to be an expert on the paranormal. You can't be a Bigfoot expert because there's no nothing to say what's an expert and what's not. There's no body of knowledge you must understand to be classified as a Bigfoot scholar or a UFO scholar. Yeah. I mean, if we had a body of a Bigfoot we could study, then we could start creating classes to understand Bigfoot.
Wes Germer from Sasquatch Chronicles frequently says no one has one in their garage. So, you know, nobody's an expert.
Yeah, so I do take a little bit of a umbrage at that because I hear that about UFOs too. People can be experts of the lore. People can be experts of dates.
Yes.
So I mean, like, while you can't be an expert of the actual thing, there are things that are, there are people, individuals who are de facto experts about, you know, aspects of it.
That's a very good
point. In other words, so you can be an expert of the truth of what people have said, but you can't be an expert of the truth of what things actually are. That makes sense.
Yes, that is a perfect way of putting it. And realistically, just because you have a PhD next to your name doesn't mean you really know what you're doing either. You can be good at reciting and spitting back information that's given to you without ever really learning it or
slow clap.
Understanding it. And of course, that's also teaching, when people go to college. Now, there are plenty of people who come out of college. They're brilliant. They achieve great things. But there's also a lot of people that come out of college and they stick right behind. And we go back to dogma again. They follow that dogma that they were taught. And they don't really ever step outside of it because they think, well, this is everything.
And a lot of people don't want to.
Well, that's true.
And I'm sure you guys have run into this in regards to this kind of stuff. Every now and then you just find some person's like, nope, don't want to know. Don't care. Don't want to know what that was in the sky. Don't want to know what those lights were. Don't care.
Yep. Oh yeah. Yep. The other podcast that I really loved, and unfortunately there's not a lot of episodes, is called Spines. And it is creepy and weird as hell. They have almost two seasons. I can't remember if they started on the third, but they're like 20 minutes long and they're only like 10 episodes a season. So it's not a lot. And I was really getting into it and I went, wait, I'm out of episodes. Oh, crap. And I can't even describe what Spines is about. It is a weird, weird freaking show. And it's definitely worth listening to if you like really weird stuff. And Ars Paradoxia, I finally caught up with. And if you like time travel, that's the one to listen to, because that will really mess with your head. And as they either had this planned out fairly well, from the beginning, or they are really freaking good at winging it. I don't know which, but you know, they'll do something in the first season and you think, well, you're not going to hear anything more about that. That was just a thing. And then they halfway through the second season, they follow up on it. You're going, really, did you have that planned out? Or do you just see an opportunity to connect it to that? Because that was pretty brilliant. And in that version of time travel, if I understand it right, every time someone goes back in time, everything is new, like from that point on. It's not so much multiple timelines, unless I'm misreading it a little bit. But the idea is like the timeline literally changes. So if you went back from if you went back into the past and then changed things so you weren't born, it wouldn't matter. You'd still be in the past because now it's a new timeline.
That makes the most sense of most. That makes more sense than most time travel fiction I hear.
It does make a lot of sense. It's a little confusing, as any time travel story can be. I mean, there's a reason they call it Ars Paradoxia, you know, because it is very paradoxical trying to listen to it and work it out in your head. And of course, they keep shifting it slightly, but it's almost like the path is linear. It's just linear moving through time, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's worth checking out, though. It's a really good show. And again, I caught up with it and went, aw, now I got to wait for episodes. And I really do think fictional podcasting is a beautiful thing. Because people can tell the stories they want to tell. They don't have to worry about visuals. You know, it's a medium that's, I think, just starting to take off and come into its own.
I can see it.
Because some of
there's room for that. Yeah, there's definitely room for that.
Well,
the stories on these podcasts are so original. You would never see them on a television show.
Right, because there's no executive noting them to death.
Right, right, exactly. Oh, people aren't going to understand this.
To bring this full circle, I have trouble listening to a fictional podcast because I feel like I feel guilty because I should be listening to a paranormal podcast and you know improving my knowledge of things
or my friend's podcast. For instance, I haven't listened to the last couple of episodes of Strange Familiars yet because I was busy listening to Spines and Ars Paradoxia. I'm sorry, Jim.
Well, speaking of full circle and Strange Familiars, this is going to be a good full circle thing. So there's a listener of both Where Did the Road Go and Strange Familiars. Her name's Vanessa. And she's very super nice. Writes me with a lot of comments, usually, good stuff. And she wrote at some point, and I forget exactly how it came up. It was after your show, Soraya, with the small town monsters guy. Yeah.
Oh,
She said to me something of the fact that I don't agree with Soraya. He said that Bigfoot is just a woods poltergeist. And I said, well, wait a second, hold on. Like he just came out and said that's what it is. And she's like, and she said, like, listen to the, and I hadn't listened to that episode yet. So I listen to that episode. And you do say something, like, if you just take the quote, you know, if you looked at it written down, it would look like mm-hmm. you were declaring that. You know what I mean? But I think right. while we're sort of clarifying things and listener questions, we could sort of address it. I mean, not to speak for you, but I was kind of like, I don't think like he really specifically thinks that's all it is. I think he meant that's like one possible answer.
No. Well, I think I was
that's my baby.
I think I was the one that was pointing out that some of this stuff was like a poltergeist type of thing. Like you got the stones throwing and stuff. And then you added in vocalizations or whatever. Not when you see a Bigfoot. And then you coined the term wilderness poltergeist because a lot of this stuff, like the stone throwing, and if I'm not mistaken, stones that are thrown by Bigfoot are often warm, which is exactly what you see in poltergeist.
You've got warm stones, disembodied voices, weird noises,
knocks,
smells that happen.
Knocks.
Knocks, yep. Like you said, knocks, Tim, knocks, and, you know, raps is what I would probably say. And it all manifests sort of in the same way. What I've wondered is, and not that Bigfoot is a wilderness poltergeist, but maybe something about a Bigfoot is in that sort of same mind state as a lot of the children who are attached to poltergeist phenomena, and Bigfoot are actually generating poltergeist effects. That's one idea, or maybe it is, you know, wilderness poltergeist, but I think there's some interesting little similarities there that don't get talked about a lot.
The problem with that is that most poltergeist accounts, most can be traced back to like an individual who, as I said earlier, it's usually someone of around just before puberty, has a lot of problems, and that doesn't describe most Bigfoot hunters who see Bigfoot. It doesn't or have these experiences.
No, but
in the
I'm
woods.
Saying maybe it describes Bigfoot. Maybe Bigfoot,
No, yeah. It's totally a possibility. And I mean, there could be something about certain areas of the woods that set these abilities off on perfectly normal people, and it creates a Bigfoot because we're not in a house. What are you going to see in the woods? Are you going to see a big ape? So your mind creates this big ape unconsciously, independent of you. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that I know what Bigfoot is, because I have no idea what Bigfoot is. Bigfoot is confounding as any of this other stuff, because you look at certain things and you say, well, that's totally a real animal out there that we haven't discovered. And then you look at other things and go, well, wait a minute. No, that doesn't make any sense if it's a real animal that we just haven't discovered.
Right. I wanted to sort of bring that up. A, for Vanessa, she's a great listener. Like I said, she listens to both shows, but also for you to clarify, kind of like go ahead and put it down that you didn't specifically mean like that's all it is. In other words, you know, it's one possible answer of many possible answers.
And I thank Peter for his concern about my sanity and me getting too dogmatic, but I can assure you that's not the case. And for anyone who thinks that I've stated anything absolute about this phenomena, I really haven't. I don't know what any of this stuff is. I'm fascinated by different concepts. I'm totally for speculating. I like pointing out connections between the phenomena and trying to see. What I want to do is I want to throw out the assumptions. That's what I want to do. You know, and that like the wilderness poltergeist idea is a great one, because if you throw ape in the woods out and you look at a lot of these cases where people don't actually see a Bigfoot, but they have the vocalizations, the knocking, and so on and so forth. What differentiates that from
there are certainly a lot of common factors. I mean, a lot.
And the big thing that would differentiate is that poltergeist accounts usually surround, as I said, a young child, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to have a very specific cause and effect. Whatever's actually behind it, it follows certain patterns, which you're not seeing in the cases, but you're in the Bigfoot cases, but you are seeing.
Right.
Some
but
of the
but
same
at the
effect.
Same time, I think a lot of people make these jumps. Like if I'm in the woods, and particularly if I'm in the woods, maybe looking for Bigfoot, and I get stones thrown at me, must be a Bigfoot. Well, no, you can't, unless you see it throw the stones, you really can't say that.
Yeah. You've primed yourself to think that.
Right. Exactly.
Yes. And that is a problem with a lot of this stuff. And if we can achieve anything with this show, one of the things I want to achieve is getting people to throw out those assumptions. It's okay. It's okay to keep them there as long as you're willing to also throw them out and look at the idea without those assumptions attached. You know, if you decide, nope, I like those assumptions, you can go back to them. They're not going anywhere. But I think if we actually want to even gain a slight foothold on this stuff, getting rid of those assumptions is the very first thing we need to do. And that's on all of it. Like it's like throw out the extraterrestrial idea assumption, also throw out the interdimensional idea assumption.
The assumption that ghosts are dead people, I think is a huge one that like,
right.
You really need to throw that out. I mean, I'm not saying they aren't, I'm just saying, yeah, well, maybe, yeah.
It's totally a possibility. Throw out the assumption, though, and then look at it from another angle without the assumption and see if you come to the same conclusion. What other things come to mind? I mean, that's what I'm looking. If I could get more people doing that by doing this show, that would be a huge plus. I mean, if I have a goal at all in the show, it's not to create Church of Fortiana or any kind of dogmas to eliminate that type of thinking and to get people to think more open-mindedly, look at stuff in different directions and approach it from different directions and look at and compare it to things that they're not normally compared to. And maybe we'll come up with some new stuff.
I don't know what the word for amen is in the Church of Fortiana, but that.
All right. To take you out of this conversation, I thought this was appropriate. This is Devo Spice, Nothing But Truth. See you next time.
Beautiful girls all over the world are really from space. Here they're an alien race. Here this is nothing but truth, baby. Nothing but truth, baby.
Nothing but truth, babe. Nothing but truth. I know this may be a big surprise, regardless of the truth that is right before your eyes. But alien reptiles run the left wing, and the government's covered up every damn thing. And you may laugh at my tinfoil hat, but I can prove to you that the earth is flat. Just take a good look at the moon, man, and you'll see that it's really nothing but a hologram. There's so much nonsense and all these concepts that people just accept as fact, like the existence of KO, Daily Mail. Can't you see this is all an act to prepare us for the pending alien attack? Us to serve on Big Macs and constantly eat a ton of salty snacks. Salty snacks.
Aliens like their food salty.
Robotic squirrels and reptilian girls were already placed here right in front of the face. Here, this is nothing but truth, baby.
Nothing but truth, babe. Nothing but truth.
Nothing but truth,
baby. Nothing but truth, babe. Nothing but truth.
They have been here.
They're here. Truth. I'm astounded that folks don't uncover stuff. I've been around and I've seen all the cover-ups. I mean, it's not like the government hides it well. Obama's a lizard, you can clearly tell. Now they're breaking down borders, killing reporters, tracking everybody with the chips in their quarters. You are just a pawn in their new world order. Stop. Now think about it. Spraying London, spraying Paris, spraying chemtrails everywhere. They spray every country except Norway, because Norway was never there. Never there.
And for that matter, neither is Delaware. Oh, don't act like you weren't aware. When's the last time you met someone from Delaware? See, huh?
All of those food stamps that we all pay for,
we pay for,
are laced with some drugs to sterilize all the poor.
All of
this is nothing but truth,
baby.
Nothing but truth, baby.
Nothing but truth, baby. Nothing but truth.
Poisonous snow.
It's snowing.
That just wouldn't.
Everywhere I go, I encounter something new.
New.
And I only say this to enlighten all of you.
You.
So let me show you the truth as I host my own panel. On my brand new show on the History Channel.
Beautiful girls.
Yes.
Nothing but truth. The gates of hell open beneath Denver International Airport. We'll tell you where to go and what restaurants to avoid during your layover. And our special report on Cabbage Patch Dolls. Do they resemble what mutant children will look like after a nuclear holocaust? And are you posting pictures on Facebook for Throwback Thursday? Then you're allowing the NSA to catalog photographs that were taken before Facebook existed. Don't post another picture until you see our special report. Stay tuned to the History Channel, your source for the real truth.